Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are continuing our mythology series with Talitha Cumi. I think I said that right. The season finale for season 3, and we have a very special guest. We have Keith Ulick back today. Hi, Keith.
Hi, everybody. How are y'all doing?
We are doing awesome.
Great. Thank you so much for having me back for a second time.
Well, your first time went over very well. Everyone loved listening to you. So we thought that it would be fun to have you back to actually discuss the show, since last time we all just sort of geeked over PaleyFest. But this time we get to get into some mythology.
Yes.
When I reached out to you about which episodes that you would like to discuss, these were the two that you chose. And I wanted to know why.
Yeah, good question. Well... So it's my kind of supposition, basically, that Talitha Cumi is the it's actually the end of some things. So, for example, John Bartley, that's his last show as cinematographer. I think you can kind of see in the switch over from Talitha Cumi to Herrenvolk, the visual style changes somewhat. You know, we can get into like the DP work on the fourth season because it was rather tumultuous, I know, because they had three DPs over the entire season. But, you know, visually, it's an interesting changeover for things. I also think first of all, Talitha Cumi has one of my favorite scenes in all the mythology, which maybe we can get to in a little bit if as we go through it. Also, I think it's kind of the point at which the mythology starts to become really wheel spinny. I find it interesting. But I also think that while the broader arc may become more wheel spinny, what's interesting about it is that this is where the personal stuff really starts to hit with everything with the smoking man and Mulder's mother and all that, which we now know kind of carries over through the rest of the series. I kind of wanted to get into it on that level, because I also remember, if we go back to my previous conversation when I was on here, I didn't become an Uber fan until middle of season 4, with Leonard Betts, as you recall, but I was consistently watching the show at this point. And I do remember that girl I mentioned, Jenny Ahn, who got me into, the show, you know, in high school. I watched Talitha Cumi when it premiered with her and a bunch of other people. And this was the point, it seemed, where she got off the train.
Ah, interesting.
Where it was just like, oh, it's not interesting anymore. And I was like, I think it's so interesting and all this. So, it's kind of like in my own X-Files evolution, a very personal point of when I think I started to realize that, okay, people are not going to be sticking with this. True. And so there's kind of a bittersweet thing to it, because this is maybe also the moment when I start to realize, oh, I'm kind of alone in everything. Which is a good thing, though, because then, I could cultivate my own perspective on it. But so, yeah, that's a long way of saying that there's a lot of interesting things that are wrapped up in this two-parter for me. And maybe we can explore them more specifically as we go on.
Yeah, this is an interesting turning point. I agree with you. And this is one of those episodes I actually don't watch very often. And then whenever I do, I realize there's like a lot of very important information in here, like a lot. And a lot of it is just very brief, like blink and you miss it, which I think is important to point out as an episode that maybe gets buried amongst a lot of more popular mythology episodes. As I was watching it, I was thinking that this would be a really good one to discuss with you, because there's a lot of nitty gritty to get into. What were you going to say, Jen?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel a bit like, I felt at the time a bit like Keith's friend, that the mythology kind of started to lose me at this point. Like, I don't remember anything about watching these two episodes. I mean, I did, obviously, but I remember nothing about it. Like, clearly did not stick with me. I think that maybe there's something about this stage in the mythology for people that had been watching from the beginning, that it starts to feel like exactly like you said, Keith, wheel spinny. Mm-hmm. And we weren't really used to that necessarily at that point. I mean, all of us got used to it over the coming seasons and kind of either came to hate it or accept it. But it was still kind of new to me, that sense of, oh, this isn't actually going anywhere after all. So I think that it started to lose me a bit. But going back and looking at it now, like Annie said, there's a lot in it, actually. And I enjoyed these episodes way more than I remembered ever enjoying them. And so I'm really glad I got a chance to watch them again. And I'm glad I have a chance to talk about them today.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say the cliffhanger in Anasazi is, like, so big.
Yeah.
Thing. And that and Blessing Away and Paperclip, that whole arc is just like, you know, it just carries you along with how tense it is. That here, you know, the cliffhanger is basically they show up at a mill, the bounty hunter comes, and Jeremiah Smith says, he's here to kill me, and then just fades out.
It's like, right. It's just classic, yeah. Like, we're just going to end the story here. It could be like, it could have been just a normal two-parter. Doesn't necessarily feel like a season finale.
Yeah. That was the thing, too, I remember. The season, it didn't feel like what one expects a season finale to feel like, which I think, yeah, it feels like this could be more in, it could have been more in a Colony Endgame, like mid-season.
Yeah, it definitely feels like
better that way, frankly, narratively. But, you know, I mean, it came when it came. And, would I consider this, like, the weakest cliffhanger of season finales?
I think it probably is.
Yeah. And that's funny to say, because I mean, I'm just thinking, like, Gethsemane, the end, like, yeah, no, all the others are kind of like,
yeah,
pretty intense. Big. Yeah, big. Yeah. This one isn't. And you're right. Yeah. It does feel like it would have been a perfectly good cliffhanger for just an average two-parter mythology, like a Tunguska Terma or something like that. But the fact that it's positioned at the end of the season makes it feel like it should be more important. So
yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons why I was never a huge fan of this two-parter, because of where it came. Mm-hmm. I expected a lot more. Right. And the stakes are just not that high at this point at the cliffhanger. I mean, obviously the stakes are always high, but when you compare it with all the other season finales, there's no, like, imminent threat to Mulder and Scully, unless we're supposed to think the alien bounty hunter is gonna kill them as well. But it doesn't feel like a big moment for them personally at that moment.
I mean, the threat is, I think, with Mulder's mother, who is clearly hanging by a thread, which means something to us because it means something to Mulder. But
sure,
like Keith just mentioned, I mean, this is really the first time we're kind of getting into that. And so we aren't really aware yet of a lot of the Mulder family dynamic. We know some, we know bits and pieces, but this is the first time that we're really starting to be like, okay, well, this is going to be a big thing. Like, this is going to become part of the mythology. And while you say that, yeah, this is wheel spinny, and there were lots of things that people were like, okay, I'm backing off. There's a lot of things in these two-parters that are picked up and resolved and carried through the end of the series. And I don't, yet again, I always say this, I just don't think the mythology gets enough credit for that. Just because people don't like it doesn't mean it's not making sense, you know?
Exactly. So I think looking back on it, it seems more significant than it felt at the time.
Yeah.
I think watching it at the time, it didn't really feel like, where is this going? We're not learning anything, really. This all seems to be dead ends. We had no idea the bees were going to come back, anything like that. So looking back on it, it has a lot more significance and interest, I think.
And there's a lot of information that's dropped in such a way that it doesn't feel as important as it should. It just feels kind of like, oh, they're just doing more of their purple prose. They're just talking at each other. They're just saying words to each other that mean nothing. I'm tuning out. And I'm thinking of specifically of the jail sequence with Jeremiah Smith and Smoking Man, which is very important. It has a lot of very important information. But I just know maybe it's just not written as well as maybe it could have been. Or maybe that's purposeful, because a lot of these threads they maybe want you to forget about or drop. Well, I'm not sure.
Well, it's interesting for me. I mean, I love the jail scene dearly. You know, it's like two dialogue scenes that are kind of broken up with the Smoking Man and Jeremiah Smith, who morphs the first time into Deep Throat, Jerry Hardin's character, and then the second time into Mulder's quote father, Peter Donat, who, you know, if we're going the biology spirituality thing that I did, he's a spiritual father to Mulder, where Smoking Man is a biological one. But I also, the thing it was, and I knew this at the time, I actually forgot it because I just watched the two episodes right before I jumped on this call because I figured let's have him really fresh in my mind. I'd forgotten that at the beginning, the shooting takes place in this fast food restaurant, and it's called the Brothers K, which is Brothers Karamazov, which is Dostoevsky, which Carter is intentionally riffing on in the jail scenes. In the dialogues between Smoking Man and Jeremiah Smith, which is within the novel, as I'm understand it, because actually I'm derelict on my Russian literature reading it. But but I do believe what it is that within the novel, The Brothers Karamazov, there is a kind of a story within the story where I think it's Jesus it might be Jesus, but it's like basically a religious figure interrogated by the Grand Inquisitor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sorry again that I'm derelict on the actual history.
I don't know anything about this, so you are not derelict.
Yeah,
I promise.
You're the expert today, so we'll believe whatever you tell us.
Yeah.
But I remember him talking about this at the time that he was Carter, that he was kind of really inspired by this Dostoevsky story and this kind of story within the story, which I think is appropriate to X-Files, which has stories within stories, of which go somewhere, others which don't. So those two dialogue scenes always resonated like really deeply with me, just because I could sense he was kind of pulling from this weighty text of literature. Giving it his own spin, and the way William B. Davis and Roy Thinnes and Jerry Harden and Peter Donat like all perform it, those scenes have to me this weight to them and like portentousness to them, and knowing where the story goes and everything, it kind of like it's they've always hit me like extremely powerfully.
Mm-hmm.
The point being though that those scenes are Carter riffing intentionally on like Brothers Karamazov, and that's why the fast food restaurant is called Brothers K.
Didn't know any of this. It's interesting. I don't know, Jen, if you knew any of that, but
I knew it thanks to my good friend Wikipedia. Mm. I also haven't read any Dostoevsky actually, so I'm not up on it. But Keith, am I right? Or more accurately, is Wikipedia right in saying that a lot of that Dostoevsky stuff was on was sort of fueled by David Duchovny's influence? Because he has like a story co-credit on the episode. And from what I understand, he had a big part of that. What do you know about that?
I do believe that is correct. I think I tried in the Paley Center to suss out a little bit more of what story by David Duchovny and Chris Carter exactly meant in David's Because the writer's room on X-Files was not, I think, what people specifically think of kind of like a writer's room today, which tends to be more of a hive mind.
Right.
It was more, everybody did have meetings, group meetings and whatever. But mostly, I think, as I'm to understand it, the writers just went, their own way and mm-hmm. then would back to Carter, and Carter would do his polish on everyone except Darren Morgan, because you can't polish Darren Morgan. and also since David was acting, I think, as I recall, I did get somewhat out of him that, because I think his first story credit is it Colony?
Yeah.
I think so.
I think it's Colony. And as I'm to understand, the bounty hunter is mainly his idea. Mm-hmm. I think then when the bounty hunter came back again, he probably influenced that, though I do think you're right, Jen, on the David Duchovny does read a lot, as I recall. I've forgotten what his dissertation was on, but I have a feeling it was something literature related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as we know, he's a very smart man too. As I recall, that is he did have influence on that choice, although all the dialogue in those two scenes between Smoking Man and Jeremiah Smith, just feels so Carter inflected.
It does
in their verbiage and in the rhythm and the portentousness and how they're in how it's performed and everything, and in basically seeming to tell you everything while telling you nothing.
And I think that's the part that can get frustrating, because it's like, I know that there is information here that's important, like I'm aware, but I find myself almost like this type of verbiage that Carter does puts me into this funk, like this haze, and my mind just starts to like loop around in a circle, and I go, wait, what are we talking about again? What? And I feel like this happens no matter how many times I watch these scenes. Like I try and get a handle on exactly what it's saying, and I think it is intentional. I mean, this is supposed to be sort of this almost circuitous, I can't say that right, conversation that doesn't really have a beginning and an end. They're just kind of feeding into each other and going back and forth, and you're just kind of like, wait, what happened here? What is happening?
What was that? I find the only way that I can make anything of those conversations in terms of what we are to take from them and what specifics there are in there is to read them, to read the transcript of them, because it is hard to get it all when they're talking, I find, because it is a very literary style, that conversation.
Yeah.
So it works better in writing, in my opinion, than it does to listen to it as dialogue. I mean, Keith uses the word portentous, which is very positive. To me, it was more pretentious.
Yeah,
I've never been a fan of that style in particular of Chris Carter. And it feels a little weird in this episode. Like, hey, let's drop a two-man play into the middle of this episode, which is kind of what happens. It's very powerful in and of itself, but does it fit with the rest of the episode? I don't know. And it took me a while, like Annie says, to realize, oh my gosh, there's actually really important stuff happening here.
Yeah.
And important imagery and themes that are coming through there that I'm starting to get now.
Yeah, I mean, you did bring up, Jen, the sense of it feeling like a play dropped into the middle of it, which I think also is a structural allusion to, like, Brothers Karamazov, that the Grand Inquisitor scene, as I'm to understand in the novel, is dropped right into the midst of that.
Right.
It's, and also, I mean, I think the first time, there's some Carter verbiage like in Colony Endgame, but it's not quite. Season three is where it really starts to get crazy, like with Blessing Way, you know, with everything that Floyd Redcrow Westerman's character.
Albert Hostein,
thank you. There's so much.
We love Albert.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love Albert.
Yeah, we talk about him a lot.
Yeah, he's great, but like his whole, like, you know, narration and monologue stuff, that's very Carter inflected. And then
works with him, though, weirdly. I mean, we've discussed this before with Albert Hostein. I mean, he's like a storyteller, and you come to expect that type of verbiage from him. Whereas, like, when I see, like, Smoking Man delivering this stuff, I'm just like, oh my God, just shut up. Like, I don't know why. It just really annoys me a lot of the time. And
I think CSM can get away with it to a certain extent. I think that I can believe he actually talks like that.
It's not that I don't believe it. I just, like, I don't know. It's hard to explain what I'm feeling, but it's just kind
it's
of like
about the delivery.
Yeah, they're both posturing at each other. And I feel like it's like, I like that element of their dynamic in this scene, because they're both trying to constantly sort of get a one-up on each other. But at the same time, you get the feeling that Jeremiah Smith doesn't care. Like, he's just kind of like, I already know how this is going to all play out. So I'm just sort of sitting back and letting it all happen. I feel like that's kind of his attitude. But anyway, let's get to that scene later. Let's start back at the beginning and run through this a little more chronologically. And we will definitely have more to say about that jail scene when we get to it. So first of all, Talitha Kumite means little girl, which I actually did not know. I had never looked that up in my entire life.
Yeah, I think it's rise, little girl, right?
I think it's like little girl, get up.
Yeah, because it's that's the Jesus connection, I think. I believe Jesus spoke that to a dead girl. It was sort of like a Lazarus type thing,
yeah.
And rise, you know. Yeah. And so it's him resurrecting, you know, using his powers to raise the dead.
Right.
Yeah. And it's in Aramaic, I believe, is the language that it comes from.
That
which
makes
was
sense.
The language that Jesus would have spoken.
It makes me think of just like, okay, like, well, so of course I think of Samantha, but then I think of like, okay, in a way it's like, okay, well, we're rising Samantha back into the storyline. Here we go. The only thing I'm really taking from this title.
And the fact that Jeremiah Smith is like, he's raising lots of people.
Right.
Going
around
healing and raising them.
That's true.
I mean, the healing aspect of it, I think, is more what he's referring to, because the Samantha part doesn't come in until Heron Volk anyway.
But she's always sort of present.
It's true. And the religious allusion or the biblical allusion is to resurrection of some sort from death or near death or whatever.
Yeah.
Of that first scene, this is where I'll get a little trivia related. Mm-hmm. The guy who is the shooter is an actor named Hrothgar Matthews, Is in the 1013 universe. I know him most specifically from a Millennium episode he would then do the year later called Loin Like a Hunting Flame, where he is the serial killer in that. He's like a, as I recall, a sex obsessed, you know, guy who likes filming couples and everything. And it's one of the, it's one of these episodes that I think most people hate of Millennium. I kind of like it. And it's the last one I think that David Nutter did, if I'm not mistaken, because David Nutter directed a few in the first and then, you know, didn't. So, yeah, trivia.
Yeah, nice. That's nice. Cool. That's a cool connection. That guy does have kind of a creepy vibe. And so I believe it that he was a serial killer at some point.
People always want to cast him as a murderer, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I think this entire scene is really cool. I mean, this is kind of where we first introduce the concept, I think, Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, but of the healing powers that these alien beings have.
Yeah, because because you find out that it's not just Jeremiah Smith who has it, the alien bounty hunter has it.
Yeah,
and there's the episode which we can talk about later, but yes, and up until this point, it's an interesting contrast. And you know, as I've talked in the past about how the show often delves into contrasts of things like, you know, spiritual father, biological father, hot cold, in terms of, like, you know, the cold like keeps the aliens on ice, hot kind of like accelerates their development and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the whole arc of the series is like the chill of the Mulder Scully relationship becoming hotly melodramatic, you know. That's kind of the move.
Ooh, I like that.
over the arc of the series.
Yeah.
So here now we get like these bounty hunters and these aliens who have been, you know, effectively we've seen them as a destructive force. And now we see they have this kind of healing force. Although what's interesting, you know, is that Smoking Man will later say with Jeremiah Smith in that cell, or Jeremiah Smith, I think, will say that he sees humans as better than the alien race, despite these powers, which I think is very interesting. And, you know, actually much more optimistic than or an optimistic appraisal of the human race, and I think the series in toto ultimately plays out as. So.
Yeah. Well, and I like the idea that this character, Jeremiah Smith, is like the first sort of alien character we're seeing with these sort of, I guess, scruples. Like, I may not necessarily agree with what's going on here. And it's, without outwardly saying it, it's sort of planting the seeds for this like civil war we're gonna get later in season 5, that this is not as simple as it appears. This is not just like, hey, we all agree we're gonna come invade. Like, no, these alien beings also have their own sort of personalities and their own goals or whatever, and they may not always align, which I find sort of interesting here. And this guy's clearly become, I would say, disillusioned, in much the way that Bill Mulder and Well Manicured Man and all these other syndicate members sort of start to branch off and do different things and have different motivations. And I think that's really interesting that we're getting to see that in season 3, you know?
Yeah. Additionally, I'm because I'm now checking IMDb, our shooter was Hrothgar. That actor was also in The Host in Our Town, as well as The Jersey Devil.
I was going to say, he looked familiar.
He looks really familiar, yeah.
Jersey Devil, I know he plays a homeless man who, in, you know, gives Mulder information and everything. And I can sort of picture him in The Host in Our Town, but it's sort of like, you know, he was one of those kind of standbys on the show, or, you know, one of the local Canadian actors, you know, would keep auditioning, and then they gave him everything. I know there's another person in the cast. One of the people who gets shot, yes, is this actor named Angelo Vacco, who worked on the show in several cases. And I'm trying to find, because he's in a lot. You first see him in F. Emasculata. I think he's one of the guys who, like, you know, gets one of the boils in F. Emasculata, like explodes and everything. But he's the one in the opening scene who gets shot and then talks with Scully when she comes in. He's like, I felt the bullet enter me, and then, you know, he was standing, and I couldn't feel my legs, and then he was standing over me and healed. So, and I know that Angelo, and then Angelo Vacca was also in Milagro and Improbable, interestingly enough. So,
right.
I always like finding like the supporting actors who have like one scene or something, and kind of just, oh, that guy recurred as this and that, and you can just sort of see like the stock company from which everybody.
Yeah. I can now, because he did look familiar to me. Now I remember him specifically from Milagro. Wasn't he like, he was with his girlfriend in the car and they were getting frisky. And now I remember, because he looked really familiar to me in the episode, and I didn't have a chance to look him up. So thank you for that, Keith. Now it won't drive me crazy anymore.
And I think there was some other things. Okay, but yeah, here we go. Like, he was the assistant to Rob Bowman on the X-Files movie.
So there was a big recurring connection.
So he has behind the scenes stuff and he has on screen stuff. Right. He's a voice actor too at times and everything. Oh. So yeah, I mean, it just, again, I know it's trivia, so
that's good. We love trivia around here.
We can get more into the meat of the show though.
Trivia is the meat as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I have a question about this healing process, and this is just a nitpick, but why is there no blood on this guy's shirt? Does the healing also take away the blood?
Well, it looked like it did, didn't it? When he was healing the shooter, didn't the blood kind of start to sort of dissolve?
Yeah, it's like, what, did it kind of just undo the shoot? It's not really like it's healing. It's just undoing it. That's what
Except
it feels
it left
like.
The bullet hole behind in the that shirt. Young man's shirt.
I was like, okay, why is there a bullet hole but no blood? I don't know why, but this stuck out to me and it bothered me. I was like, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think also if you really want to pick some continuity there, when the shooter gets shot, he grabs himself on this side, but then when he's on the ground, the bullet hole's on this side.
Oh.
So they don't have the exact,
or maybe it was like a mirror image that they used and then they didn't realize that they didn't line up. I don't know, this could just be dumb like me nitpicking, but I everything sometimes means something, and so I was just like, what exactly is going on here? I bet you it's just a dumb mistake. But
I was just gonna say, I feel like I was more distracted by the fact that the blood disappears but the bullet hole didn't. I feel like if the bullet hole had also disappeared, it would all make sense to me. Like, it just undoes everything that happened. But maybe it's just like anything biological. Maybe he only has control over biological things.
That is what I would say. And I kind of like the idea of something that's alive is what he has control over. But, you know, there's still evidence if we want to go the scientific route. You know, the spiritual side, it erases the biological evidence. But anything that's not alive, like a shirt is not alive, will maintain the evidence. And I like that dichotomy, because that'll give Scully something to be like, ah, science.
Then it removed the blood from the shirt because the blood is technically alive. Is that what you're saying?
And Mulder can be like, oh, woo, 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 you know, crazy.
It's a great Mulder imitation just at that moment.
Yeah. It makes me think all the way over to the very, very last shot of the series with William and his bullet hole in his head and the idea that, like, he's able to heal himself as well. But the bullet hole looked the same to me. And so I thought of that. Let's talk about Scully. We have what I would like to call a glow up with Scully. She, and I mean, from season 3 to season 4, I feel like is where they both sort of kind of became hot. I have to just say it.
Hotter.
Yeah, but like this is where it kind of started. I remembered watching her walking into this fast food and I'm like, oh, Scully did something to her hair. And then there's another change. These are the things we talk about too, Keith. There's another change in Hair Invoke when she looks a slightly different too, because like I said, I think season 4 was the moment that they were like, oh, okay, let's push this angle. But I just wanted to bring that up because she's looking really good in this episode. Good job, Scully.
Yeah, well, I will say that I remember the first time I really was like, oh my God, they're glowing Scully up. It's a few episodes past this. I think it's in Tunguska when they put her in jail for contempt of court.
Yeah.
And show this long shot of her, like, you know, power walking down the hallway of the jail. And it's just like her suit now is no longer frumpy, but it's perfectly formed.
It's tailored,
Just the costume budget, you know, like went up. And they got more tailors on set. But I was just like, damn, girl, you look great.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Season 4, the season of hotness.
I remember that. And of course, you know, then you like go back to season 2 when they're like trying to hide the pregnancy. And even now everybody says, oh, she looked pregnant. Of course she did.
Yeah.
Gigantic maternity, like, you know, suits over her.
Huge trench coats. Yeah.
And I mean, also, you want to talk another change. I mean, Mulder's hair between Talitha Kumi and Herrenvolk, it's like, you know, they sort of try to cover it, but it's like that. It's that season 4, like part in the middle thing. I remember
With the little floppy, like, curls.
The, that I remember Entertainment Weekly, I think it was at the time, said when they were reviewing it, like Herrenvolk, it was like, Mulder has another bad haircut.
Bless.
I love season four, Mulder.
But, you know, I mean, yeah, it's the hair, the wardrobe, the glow up is very much a thing. It's especially evident now in the high def remasters where it's just like, sort of see like, whoa, hello.
Yeah, fully appreciate it now.
Yeah, which I guess also, this also kind of hits on the my idea of the theme of like this is an episode that's so integral to a kind of change in the series, almost like an alchemical change within.
Visually, going along with your visual,
To go along with the visual stuff and everything, they start to look different. I think it's kind of like, it's both the confidence, but also probably they're at a point where it's like, yeah, we know what we're doing now, and we're just going to, we're going to go up and we're going to do it. You know, the I think maybe this is another thing. It's like the sense of discovery is really at this point, this is the last time I kind of feel that.
Yeah.
And now, from here on, it's kind of like everybody knows basically what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think there can be a pleasure to that. I mean, that's why I'm a Law and Order junkie, because it's just like, once Law and Order hits its like stride, it's just kind of like, it's so professional and just like,
everything's running on all cylinders and it's,
blah, blah, blah. And I think that show is trash, but you know, and every iteration of it is utter trash, but it's like trash in the kind of like, you know, like an old Hollywood programmer sense, where it's just like, yeah, we have the mechanisms of everything we're going to do. We know exactly how we're going to do it. We're going to get it done in our 8-day schedule. Boom.
It's procedural in every sense of the word.
Exactly. And, and X-Files is a procedural. It's also a riff on a procedural, on a commentary on what procedural, narratives are, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's really the moment where it's just like, I think everybody's like, we know what we're doing. And, you know, there's a pleasure in that professionalism, but probably I think maybe if we're saying people working from watching from the beginning, and this is what I was firsthand witness to, people watching from the beginning started to get bored, because it was like, we know, as people on the show, maybe we know what we're doing. Viewers maybe at this point were like, we know what we're getting.
Yeah.
And how do you navigate that?
Yeah, that's tough, because you want to give them a little bit of both. You know, so
that there should always be some kind of sense of discovery. And this, of course, could lead into a whole other broader discussion of like narrative television, how long it goes on, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Although now in the streaming age, it's basically like, you know, you're lucky if you get 3 Netflix seasons, let alone 1.
Right.
Interesting time.
I think for me, the sense of discovery still continued after that point, from the sense of the characters and their relationships. That was always the main interest for me in the series. And while for me the mythology got a little wheel spinning, like you say, the characters and their relationship never really did for me. And so that's what kind of kept me going in terms of it feeling like it was making progress and feeling like it was going somewhere.
They always kept you interested.
There's always, that's the thing. Again, if there's always something where there is a sense of discovery. I think maybe in what the show was from seasons 1 through 3, it became something different. And then, you know, but there were other elements, like whenever they would bring on a new writer, I feel like that writer was kind of a sense of discovery, because they're new to the show and they're trying to figure out the procedural thing. And sometimes some of them worked better than others. I kind of am a big fan of the season 4 episode Sanguinarium, which is the only episode written by the Mayhew sisters, I believe, Valerie and Vivian Mayhew. And, it's a very gross and disgusting episode with my favorite line reading of the series. And I know it was rewritten like heavily and everything. You know, just because a writer is credited doesn't mean that they had any hand in the final draft necessarily. That's just how production works. But, you know, it's like the one-offs are always interesting. And so, you know, I would always have that whenever they would bring on a new director. You know, even like, I mean, when we get to Herrenvolk, we should talk about like Ron Stannett, the new DP, because, the switch over from Bartley to him and the whole DP drama during season four, is just like really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But I also think I like the... And maybe this is where I can bring up, like, you know, the Talitha Kumi has I said earlier, like one of my favorite scenes in the series, which is the raid on the Social Security Administration or the Social Security Office, mm-hmm. where Smoking Man, and all his minions kind of come in to get Jeremiah Smith, and Jeremiah Smith tries to sneak out, and he fails, and that's when he gets taken to the jail. I just that scene is entirely wordless and just with this great Mark Snow music behind it. And I just remember seeing it at the time, and it's only like a minute really, but it's always stuck in my head as something. I love the way it's blocked. I love the way it's edited. I love the tension that kind of like brings up in it. And then I love the cut from kind of like this, this office with all this overhead fluorescent light that just kind of flattens everything. It immediately goes to Smith being like wheeled in through this jail cell or jail hallway where there's like this, and Bartley would do this a lot during the series. There's just like this light source in the background. I think it's like this orange light, and then just like, what light source is this? And where is it? So surreal and weird and like everything. And, I on one of my X-Files one-shots things that I did, I remember the season one episode Shadows, not the greatest episode in the world, but there's a point where they come out of a hall, out of a morgue, I think, into this hallway, and there's like this rainbow lighting in the window, and it's like outside, I think, and I'm just like, what is that supposed to suggest? Is that the sun? Is it setting? Is it like, do they have a stained glass window in the morgue? But what it is like, ultimately, it's just like it's unrealistic, but it is suggestive, and. Maybe that's what I would kind of define as like the Bartley method, is like his lighting is extremely like it will go for surreal effect.
Yeah.
And I think there's an argument to be made that, and I think I said this maybe in the last podcast, that he as director of photography probably did everything that one could do on the X-Files. I do like a lot of the other director of photographies, but I don't know that they quite got to his level, because his season one through three, aside from the pilot, because Thomas Del Ruth shot that. I mean, that was, I think that run of visually is just like spectacular and always consistently inventive. And, and like, so yeah, that whole scene in Talitha Kumi where there's like no dialogue, just Mark Snow music, this fluorescent like flatness going to like this surreal like darkness and this light source, like what the fuck is this light source? It that is so, that just epitomizes what the show can do. And I think interestingly, that then helps me be with the scene with the long dialogue scene in the jail, because preceding it, you get this long dialogue free sequence.
Right. True.
And I feel like that's often missing in a lot of television shows and other things nowadays, where it's just like dialogue, 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 dialogue.
Yeah.
And like the X-Files would go for a mix of it. And that kind of gives you a balance of something. You can be with something that has no normal dialogue to it, and then it's like, but having had that kind of visual symphony, you can then just sort of sit in a conversation too. And I think not just the Smoking Man and Jeremiah Smith, but I think throughout these two-parter, there's some really lovely dialogue scenes in it, especially between Mulder and Scully, Scully and Pendril.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot to talk about in this episode. So let's go back to, I think, like the second scene where Tina Mulder is going to Quanacontog. I can't say that. I have no idea how to say that.
Well, sounds good to me.
Trouble saying it too. Quanacontog.
Quanacontog. Where this is like their summer house. Why do they still have this house? I need to know.
This is a question.
Why does it still exist, and why is it still draped in sheets, and why haven't they sold it?
Okay. Well, Jen, would you like to go first?
Oh, I have no strong theory except that I just assumed it belonged to Bill Mulder, and that he wanted to keep it for whatever reason, didn't want to part with it, and that they just haven't had a chance to sell it yet. Since
yeah, I like
that's
that.
That's how I interpreted it.
Yeah, I would go with that. I think that could be a rational explanation. And of course, Bill Mulder just died, I guess, like in the year in the series timeline, like a year prior.
Right.
But you know, also, like, why wouldn't he sell it before that? Because, you know, he and Tina Mulder, Tina, T-E-E-N-A, did get divorced and everything. But I think this, you know, also segues into how another theme of the series, which is that these characters can't let go of their pain.
Right.
You know, and the painful things that have happened to them. They actually want to hold on to it. I think the subconscious thing is they need to hold on to it because that's the thing that defines them.
Yeah.
You know, and so that then, like, that's why, you know, I remember a friend of mine, like, criticizing, like, in X-Files, I Want to Believe, why would Mulder still have, you know, his sister's picture on the wall, even though everything, he knows what happened to her, everything's been solved. I'm just like, he's never going to let go.
Yeah.
He's going to be searching for his sister even when he knows exactly what happened to her.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I like that. I like that explanation. And I mean,
like this is the pathology of Mulder and ultimately what I think where he leads Scully down, which is why, as much as I love this particular love story between them, I mean, you know, he does, it's about someone taking a rational person and kind of warping them.
Yeah.
Some, you know, too. And, but, you know, love warps people.
Right.
You know?
Right. That's a really interesting take. And I would tend to agree with that. I do notice, though, that Tina Mulder is holding a key as she arrives at this house. So she clearly has a key to this house. And I'm trying to remember, I didn't write it in my notes. Is she surprised by Smoking Man, or has he summoned her there? She seems to be surprised to see him. So how did they have this rendezvous? Like, how was this orchestrated?
I didn't think, well, I mean, I think there's two different versions of how this rendezvous happened. First of all, one that we see and sort of make our own judgments on, and then the one that CSM tells Mulder later on when he sees Mulder.
Right.
And my interpretation upon watching it at first was that she was there to meet CSM and that he had summoned her. He claims later that she had summoned him. But it strikes me that he had summoned her to ask her an important question, which I assume was, where's the alien sticky doodle thing? So that's the way I understood that whole scene.
Yeah, yes. It's just, you don't really know what the truth is. It's just one of those strange, all we have is like their reactions to each other, because that's the truth. That's the only truth that we have. And she seems like, I don't want to say maybe not surprised to see him, but she is not pleased to see him at all.
No.
She does not like him.
No.
He is so creepy in that scene, isn't
he? He's so creepy. Not as good as I was. I have just written in all caps, ew, 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 ew.
Yeah. But that could be said of so many things.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I love that Tina Mulder says, I've repressed it all.
Yeah. Well, like, you would have to. I mean, you can't come back from that. Man.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah. I remember actually being at the X-Files Expo in right before the movie came out in 98. And one of the questions that a person asked Frank Spotnitz when he came on the stage was about the Tina Mulder Smoking Man meeting. And he kind of remarked on, you know, the kind of poeticism of the dialogue where Smoking Man says, it struck me as I was standing here, everything changes but the sea, you know, and I remember, you know, kind of there was in the crowd a sort of slight collective hush as kind of everybody were like, like an intake, like everybody remembered the scene when I kind of like, you know, brought it up. It's this poetic observation by the most malevolent man you would ever think, you know, would be speaking to you poetically, and especially when you then kind of intuit, oh, he and Tina Mulder had a thing, and you know, what does this mean?
Right. I mean, and your brain immediately goes to that possibility. I mean, they've already sort of hinted and teased at the fact that Smoking Man could be Mulder's father. I mean, they started planning that fairly early, as I recall. I mean, this is pretty early, I like the idea that he's the devil, like you always say, but he's got these pretty words, like that's how the devil takes you in. And I think that's really cool. Really interesting.
And though, as I recall, this was the first real time that I got any sense that, I mean, I knew, you know, at this point that Smoking Man was involved with Bill Mulder, but that just seems like, oh, well, that was a professional capacity. Mm-hmm. This is the time that I remember, and it always sticks in my head this way, where it's like, oh, he was really personally involved.
Yeah.
Mulder family, maybe to the point of, you know, fathering a child who could be Fox Mulder.
Yeah. You know, or and, Samantha. Yeah, either yeah. or both. Yeah.
Or Samantha or both. And then, I mean, as we ultimately discover, it is Mulder and not Samantha, which then creates all this weird biology, not biological, you know, stuff that
yeah.
through the rest of the series. But yeah, I mean, at this moment, it's kind of like, I remember I was just like, what the fuck is going
yeah,
on
here? Yeah. It was the first time for me that I thought that there was any connection between them at all. And it didn't click that there was a even a slight possibility of CSM's paternity question until the end of this episode, when he's talking to Mulder and talking about and calling him Fox. And I knew her before you were born. That's when it started to be, that was when the seed was planted for me.
Yeah, but always like, you know, manipulating him, because as you point out, you know, he's telling him a different story than the thing that we actually saw.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, so, Smoking Man has always had a sort of weird obsession with Mulder, and we never really knew why. And I feel like this is kind of connecting those dots, which makes sense to me. And yeah. It's gross, but whatever. It is what it is. And interesting. I know, Jen, you always say that, like, this is part of the mythology you could do without, is this connection
yeah.
to Smoking
Man. I've never liked the idea of CSM being Mulder's father, though, I mean, Keith, you make a strong point that it opens up a lot of interesting storytelling possibilities. But at the time, I was, because I loved CSM so much as a character at that point, that at that bringing him in and suddenly turning him to Mulder's father, I'm like, it's a little corny, it's a little soap opera. But as time went on again, I started to see, you know, it just created all kinds of other interesting opportunities for the story. But at the time, I was like, I'm not sure about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's extremely soap opera.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of the things I love about it.
Yeah, this whole thing is like, I mean, it like you always say too, it's sort of based on these sort of themes, and like the idea of his lineage, his family, and finding out things that you didn't know, that you've repressed or whatever. I feel like that is all important, and it sort of informs Mulder's character in a way too.
Yeah.
That like this is something he would clearly want to fight against, and I find that interesting. So I don't know, they don't deal with it so much that it bothers me. I understand what you're saying, Jen, but it is one of those things that's kind of constantly always on the periphery, like this is now explaining why Smoking Man is so weirdly obsessed with Mulder. And
yeah, and every time we see CSM after that, it's just always in the back of our minds. So it affects his presentation and our interpretation of him from that moment on for me.
And it serves a story purpose, because it gives them a reason to keep him alive, because it's something you wonder often as you're watching this, like, why don't they just kill them? Like, they're always a thorn in their side, they're sticking their nose into business. Mulder, just kill him, Mulder. And then you understand now why Smoking Man does not want that to happen. He doesn't want to allow that to happen, at least not yet. It does make sense.
And it's this perverse mix of, like, you know, affection and like manipulation.
Yeah,
you know? I'm going through the entire arc in my head, and I'm just, my head is hurting. You know?
There's a lot there, and we'll get to all of it.
This is just the very beginning of it.
It is so intensely fucked up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is.
You're right there.
But I think that makes it really interesting.
Yeah,
Tina goes into the house at some point. I'm assuming they both go into the house. We don't really know exactly what happens, except what X tells Mulder later. And I think we can tend to trust X's version of events more than anyone else's. So X is clearly following someone. And again, I start to wonder, like, is he following Tina Mulder, or is he following Smoking Man? Why is he there to capture all of this?
And on whose behest? That's
exactly
what I was a little confused about as well. Keith, please clear this up for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, here's the thing. The previous episode to this is Wet Wired, which end has the scene where Smoking Man meets X.
Yeah.
And it seems like X is kind of like now more involved with him than we kind of realized. And so my thinking was like, you know, maybe X accompanied him, you know, on the journey, and that's why he could just be there. He was sort of like acting as a secondary.
The only reason I think that's not the case, unless we have to unravel this and think of everyone's motivation, is because Smoking Man seems surprised to see those photos. Like, he's like, who took these? Who, I mean, unless he's just putting it on, which is possible. But then they go through this whole you know, rigmarole to try and figure out about the information, like to see who is leaking their information. It's almost like if he already knew that was X there, then he probably would have already been onto X. And I mean, part of me thinks that Smoking Man is already onto X, and keeping a lot of things close to the vest. But it does seem like if he knew that X was there, then he wouldn't have been so surprised at those photos.
Everyone seems surprised by those photos. Yeah. The Syndicate guys are surprised by it. CSM is surprised. So I'm like, well, then who sent him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think it's X who took the photos. But,
yeah. Yeah.
As far as X being there, it's muddy.
Yeah.
I kind of think that maybe Smoking Man does trust some of his demonic minions more than others, and I feel like X probably was good enough that he could, you know, dissuade any sense that he might have been the one who took the photos or something. But
X is also looking for the handy dandy alien poker, pocket poker thing. What do we call that?
Is it a stiletto? The stiletto. Is there an official name for that key?
There is a name for it, and I didn't write this down. It was in the script.
It's the alien stiletto, right?
Yes, but there was another weird name for it. I think
it just looks like an ice pick to me. It's not nearly as special as they're making it sound. It's like it's the only way to kill them, and I'm like, really? It's just a pointy stick.
It was in the Memento Mori script. Well, you guys chat while I look this up.
Yeah. Well, here's my thing on the stiletto. They never say this specifically, but from what comes subsequently, it is my belief that probably what the point is made out of is that great Gillian Anderson said word, magnetite.
Mm-hmm. Magnetite.
And that probably it's like the reason it has to be housed is that when it comes out, it's extremely deadly, probably even at a prick or something. And so, you know, then my own interpretation is that the stiletto is the point is made of magnetite but it probably needs to be inserted. Well, you know, this is where we get into the weird, like this is where some things don't make sense, because it's like, you know, they do say it has to be base of the neck, it has to be precise, etc. Okay. Then, of course, in season 8, and I think it's without or something, Scully shoots the bounty hunter when he's Skinner in the back. I'm like, well, wait, was the bullet made of magnetite? Or maybe it's just you need to be really, really precise with something really forceful.
just a little confusion.
It's a discontinuity and everything. And they never specifically say, oh, the alien stiletto is made of magnetite. But when they say it's the only way we can kill them, you know.
It's got to be something more special than just a pokey thing. Right. So I'll buy the magnetite theory. That's a good one.
I like that, too, because it's the special location, obviously, is important. And clearly it can't just be a pokey thing, because anyone could just grab a pokey thing. And so
it's got to be that pokey thing. And it's really valuable.
I found it in the script. When Kurt Crawford is taken out in Memento Mori with this weapon, it says, the gray-haired man comes up the stairs, moving off in a hurry, putting the retracted gimlet weapon back in his suit pocket. I have never heard this before. Gimlet weapon.
Gimlet is a descriptive term, I think, but let me...
It's capitalized. Gimlet weapon, both capitalized. Like that's the official title, the name. Yeah. And they never say this in the actual series, but I find that fascinating.
Never heard it referred to that way.
From dictionary.com, gimlet is a small tool for boring holes consisting of a shaft with a pointed screw at one end and a handle perpendicular to the shaft at the other. It is also a cocktail made with gin or vodka, sometimes soda water.
Keith, is it pronounced gimlet or gimlet? Does dictionary.com tell us?
I believe we have a way of
gimlet.
Well, right. I find that there we go.
I'm writing that word down.
It's interesting because you're right. It does feel like a descriptive word, not like an actual title. Like, I mean, what we've seen it referred to before is the alien stiletto, which I think sounds much better. But I think it's interesting in this script how they don't say alien stiletto, but they also say this and they capitalize it. I just find that fascinating. Yeah.
That sounds like a Carter, like doing one of his portentous passes.
Yeah.
The gimlet thing. Like, I love in what is it, the Milagro, where like, you know, John Hawks' character is like talking about Scully's hair. It's like she pushed an errant strand of Titian hair.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, I know Carter is smart enough that I know he's parroting himself there. He's like, yeah, I write like this. But,
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna lean the fuck into it. So,
yeah. I mean, in Milagro, he should be leaning into it. So that totally makes sense. But anyway, the gimlet weapon. So it's possible.
Gimlet makes sense. Yeah.
We know X was looking for that as well. So it's possible that he, for some reason, knew that Tina was after it. I don't know.
He just thought Tina would know where it was. I don't know if he had any reason to think she knew what it was. Oh. We never got to that part in their conversation.
Right.
We just got as far as him saying, I want you to remember something. And then she's very keen to communicate to Mulder later on where to find this thing.
And so that's important.
She knows that's what he wants. She wants Mulder to get it. She knows where it is. We don't know all the reasons for all those things, though.
She clearly refuses to give it up to Smoking Man, which I think is important. Like, and we don't know exactly how this heart attack occurred. I mean, X tells Mulder, I believe, that she had a heart attack after he left.
Yeah, or a stroke, I think he says.
A stroke, sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, he says that it happened after CSM left and that X called 911. And I wrote down, X is like an angel to the Mulders because he saved Mulder in 731 and he saved Tina Mulder in this episode. So he's always there calling the authorities when no one else will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good on Stephen Williams.
Yeah, he's great, and I think that he's obviously going to pay for all of this at some point. But it is, I love when you see, because I think X is, we've talked about this before, me and Jen have, X is my favorite of all of the informants because I think he's the most mysterious. Like, you never really know. He's helping Mulder, and you see these moments here where he's clearly helping Mulder, but he also is very much like, no, if this isn't helping me or if this is going to put me in danger, go fuck yourself. And I like that idea because it really ups the stakes. It's not like Deep Throat just kind of giving Mulder everything and being very, very nice about it all the time. It's like, no, this is actually dangerous. Like, we need to be more careful, and you can't just come to me whenever you need information. Like, I'm putting myself on the line too. And here is where obviously that all plays out for him. So... but anyway, okay, so moving along here, Tina goes, is taken to the hospital, and I think David does some really good work in this episode with his reaction to his mother. You don't get to see him with his mother very often. This is sort of is this the first time we are really seeing him with Tina? I mean, we've met Tina before.
Yeah, we saw him, did we see him
in
with
Colony,
her?
I believe.
In Colony and Endgame. Yeah. We're all there together.
They're all there together, and then in Blessing Way, we have a scene with Scully and Tina.
Does he see her in Anasazi? Goes to see her to say, "What do you remember anything about Samantha?"
Yeah.
Something like that.
Isn't that when he asks about the choice?
Going to look up Rebecca Toulon's IMDb page just so I can remind myself of
which episodes she was in.
Which episode she was in and everything.
Yeah, but we've only seen little bits of his relationship with her. Enough to kind of get the impression to me that they had, like, he obviously has a warm relationship with her to a certain extent. He has a lot of affection for her, even if they're not, you know, there's not always a lot of truth between them. But he obviously has a lot of affection for her. That's how I interpreted that.
So, to this point, she's been in Colony, The Blessing Way, and Paperclip.
Yeah.
Paperclip, right.
Mm-hmm. And then she comes back into Lithokumi, and then she's in Heron Volk. Right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the scene in Paperclip.
It's always funny to me how you think that certain characters are in more episodes than they're actually in.
Presence.
So,
I think that's a testament to, you know, I think that when these scenes do come, they're great. They're really well written and they're well acted. And you believe that Mulder is, you know, devastated. This is like his last family member. It's really good stuff. And it's good Mulder and Scully stuff. Scully's being
great,
top notch partner, friend, everything for him here, being very supportive. I enjoy all of this. And so when Tina is finally conscious enough to communicate, she writes, you know, the anagram of LAMP on his, on her handy dandy, Scully's handy dandy notepad. He writes it on the hand. Who writes it on the hand?
No, she writes it on Scully's notepad.
The notepad. Right. Okay.
Notepad. There is another episode. Somebody writes something on their hand. I think I forget which.
Yeah.
I think I'm just mixing it up because he thinks that, because she writes palm.
It says palm.
Yeah. And he thinks clearly that this could have something to do with it, but it's funny because it's one of those moments where it does, but not for the reason he thinks it does. So it's just,
yeah.
I don't know, this whole thing with the anagram, I feel like was sort of unnecessary, but it does kind of thematically connect us to Jeremiah Smith and all the stuff that happened earlier with the healing. So I like it for
that. It's a little bit of a red herring at that point, but it kind of, it, to me as the viewer, kind of draws me in like, oh, maybe this is somehow to do with Jeremiah Smith. I mean, there's kind of an ongoing storytelling challenge in this episode of making sure that we're still equally invested in the Tina Mulder story and then the Jeremiah Smith story, and then trying as many on as many occasions as possible to make sure that they touch.
That they
and
connect,
this was a way
yeah.
of making them touch in a way that actually was not actually accurate, but was a fair leap on Mulder's point at that point. I think that it wasn't crazy for him to make that connection.
No, I mean, well, I like Mulder's crazy leaps anyway, but I do remember at the time, you know, I also kind of felt like, This was a moment, the palm lamp thing, where I was kind of like, that feels a little more written than, you know, lived.
Or
whatever. And, you know, I don't think I've ever really come to fully embrace it personally. But again, it's like, it does precipitate that what I think is a really great scene where he searches the house.
Which
is one of the dialogue-free scenes in the show. It's just him and the Snow score is underneath it, you know, and I think Talitha Kumia just has this lovely balance of non-dialogue scenes versus with dialogue scenes, you know, and it's just like that. And the way Snow's score kind of escalates as he's searching the house, you know, it gets more like intense and it's crescendoing and such. And I do love it when he discovers the stiletto and of course you get the
and the music,
it's great.
I think as everybody knows, the sound was a last minute addition because they were trying this, you know, really labor intensive like sound effect sound design thing, and it just wasn't working at all. And so I think it's Jeff Charbonneau who was the one of the sound guys. He just like stepped up to the microphone and just went, it's got to sound like, and then when was what ultimately they used. So
and that works. I mean, it's effective.
Just at a microphone, out of frustration, saying it needs to sound like, and then that's what it became.
So, I love that.
I love that too. Let's talk about the gimlet weapon for just a second, because everyone is after this thing. Is this the only one that exists? I have to ask because literally everybody wants this thing. It's very valuable. Smoking Man is even looking for it. He doesn't have access to one. Clearly he doesn't have like a briefcase full of alien stilettos, which you'd think he would have.
Okay.
Honestly.
In my opinion, up to this point, we've only seen them in Colony Endgame. So I'm guessing what it is that it's one of those things like, you know, the humans know the bounty hunters have these weapons.
Yeah.
But they don't have any of themselves. It's like the aliens, they've seen the alien technology, but they don't have the alien technology, except I think probably what we're meant to intuit is that Bill Mulder, being the rebellious sort that he was, probably stole this back in the day and hid it.
Yeah.
And it's the only evidence that a human could have that these things exist. And I'm guessing the Syndicate probably would, or Smoking Man would like to get his hands on it, because in studying it, they probably could further the vaccine cure or some other way of, like, you know, making sure that they can kill these aliens or help themselves. You know, it's again a purely self-serving thing for pretty much everyone who's searching for it.
Right. But he says that it will be valuable down the road when, or somebody says this, I'm trying to remember, maybe X is the one
that
says it.
Yeah,
it'll be valuable. Its value will skyrocket in the future, sort of like, this is the only weapon we have against them. And but it makes me think, though, that these things are very rare and hard to come by. It's not like there's an arsenal of these somewhere that can be raided, you know?
And I think probably what they want is they want to make an arsenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and but they don't
like as a prototype.
But it's kind of like, you know, the only way they get their hands on purity, the black oil, is via the aliens. So everything they've gotten from the aliens has been through intermediary or through, you know, I guess an intermediary alien or whatever. It's just like, okay, we'll give you this little piece, but you know, but you have to use it to, you know, manufacture thus and such that will help us. And then there's the, you know, and then the humans who really want to survive, you know, kind of create their own side project. It's like, we'll take the official stuff we get and, you know, and make our own little unofficial things. And I'm guessing the stiletto is meant to be part of that, you know?
Yeah.
And
so it makes me think of like having to follow, but I do wonder, because we see it used at the end of this episode in Herrenvoke, and then I'm assuming, or in Herrenvoke, the beginning, and I'm assuming that the alien bounty hunter gets it back. I'm trying to remember what happens. It's like trying to track Luke Skywalker's lightsaber throughout all of the Star Wars movies. Like, where does it go and where does it end up?
Well, the alien bounty hunter has his own.
So right.
There's two stilettos. So basically, Mulder has a stiletto that he got from the lamp. That's the thing that at the beginning of Herrenvoke, that's the one that he uses to stab the bounty hunter. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he's not precise. I guess that's what we have
and
to
do. And he doesn't
do.
Take it with him for some reason.
Doesn't he take it with him? I thought he retrieves it. What do you think, Keith?
No, he takes the bounty hunter's one. The bounty hunter drops.
Oh, okay. He takes the bounty hunter's. Okay. Well,
takes the bounty hunter stiletto, but the one in the bounty hunter
stays in his neck, right?
It stays in there, right. which I guess if we're going to try to intuit what that all means, it probably is like, oh, maybe I need to leave it in there for it to do its job.
Right.
Why didn't it do its job?
The other thing is, if he takes it out, then we're going to get into the toxic green alien blood thing.
Right. And maybe Mulder remembers that for some reason. But why doesn't it work? Do you have any theories on that?
He missed.
Really?
Yeah, it has to be like really, really super precise.
I think someone was actually asked about this, and I think Carter's answer was basically, yeah, he just wasn't precise enough.
Okay, all right, I'll buy it because I don't have a choice.
And that's like, you know, like when we get into like Two Fathers, One Son. Mm-hmm. I think it's Two Fathers where one of the syndicate members, you know, becomes a faceless alien.
And Krycek sends Spender to do it, and then
and Spender doesn't do it right.
No,
and then Krycek pops up right behind him and has that amazing like, you know, just like he immediately gets it.
So Krycek is useful.
Krycek is trained to exactly hit the exact point.
He's the Robin Hood of the syndicate.
Yeah. He's the Robin Hood generally. Yeah. Alex Krycek.
Except for the good of help the poor part of him. That's definitely not Krycek. Sure, I just mean in his accuracy. That's all I meant.
I've always taken like in Two Fathers, I think it is, where he does that. I'm just kind of like, oh, Krycek can be precise. Mulder was just like,
And I mean, you're right. I could buy it. It's just like, that's, you know, that's not going to be really easy to when the alien uprising happens and you got to start popping these aliens in the neck one after the other. I mean, maybe you get better and better at it as you do it.
Let's just say it's kind of fucking silly.
But we could say that about so many things. So
he just wasn't precise. I think that's just we can go.
All right. Well, good enough for me. And we jumped ahead for that, but that's okay. We're kind of jumping all over the place. All right. But that's fine. That's fine. Because we're covering everything and that's what's important. So we already talked about the Social Security Administration sequence where they track down Jeremiah Smith, your favorite part.
Love it.
I find that so interesting to bring up. Just let's talk about that briefly. The fact that there are multiple Jeremiah Smiths working all over, and they obviously have this very important job to do, which is keeping track of people that have been tagged with this smallpox vaccination, which is very, very, it can get confusing, but at the end it's like, okay, it does sort of make sense. Like they would need these people, these aliens, to be doing this. Like somebody needs to be tracking this, especially because the plan is already sort of being set in motion already. So I find that cool and interesting that they drop this information and then they sort of don't really touch that again, even though it's important information that we now have access to.
Yeah, well, it's basically, I think, the virtual version of the files, lots and lots of files.
Yes.
You know, like if you really do intuit, it's like probably everybody was tracked just by paper, and probably I think would still be tracked by paper file, which you see in Paperclip, I think, is where they have files in the mine. But now, as you know, technology advances, I mean, of course, the syndicate and everyone would like or the consortium. Sometimes it's the syndicate, sometimes the consortium. I've seen it both ways. But when they get computers and stuff, I would think they would want to move into that and everything.
There's
and I
mean, sort of just an update. It's yet again just a sort of evolution. With the
it's
times,
a
yeah.
Of the work, I like to think that they're doing both paper and computer. And I mean, obviously, with the revival series and stuff, eventually they would go into Dyson spheres and the colonization of space. So, you know, I mean,
they're moving with the times.
Yeah, it's another evolution. I mean, it works as we move through the decades on the show. These things are going to have to change, and it makes sense. Like the paper would be forgotten and abandoned in a mine because they've clearly moved to this different system. And I think that's great. I think that's really realistic, you know, as realistic as we can get with this. And it leads Mulder and Scully to some information, but just not quite enough. Like they're going to get just enough to get stopped because now we realize that this thread has been dropped, but with good reason. So I like that.
Yeah. I have a question about the five Jeremiah Smiths. Are we to think that those are just all random aliens that happen to have the same job in terms of the project and they just, for whatever reason, have all chosen the same face? They're not clones, are they? They're actual aliens.
Yeah. Why are they all the same person?
Why do they all look and have the same name?
No, I mean, my interpretation is they are clones, the older versions of basically the kind of clones that you see in Herrenvalk.
Mm-hmm.
And,
and
here's my really woo-woo theory, which is that the Jeremiah Smith that we get for the first half of Telithicumi, you know, up to the point where he escapes from the jail, is not the Jeremiah Smith who comes to see Scully and then continues on through Herrenvalk.
Right.
Specifically because of the way Roy Thinnes plays, you know, those what I think are two different versions of Jeremiah Smith.
Well, and at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because they're all sort of the same mind. So
of the same mind. But interestingly, and this is what's so fascinating to me, what I think we're supposed to take away from this is that they, you know, they are clones who develop speech and a conscience.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you know, it's basically like they were created as workers. You know, they now work in the Social Security administrations of different offices, but they developed the sense, the moral sense. And
well, they study human behavior probably, and this is the reason that they no longer believe in the greater purpose, and they have evolved past that. So,
and this kind of feeds into, because I remember there was the writer who wrote the criticisms for Cine Fantastique, Paula Vitaris, who was name checked in the series a few times. She really does not like the X-Files past, like, from season four on. She really goes hard into the critiques and stuff. And I remember her criticizing Herrenvalk specifically and Telithicumi too, just in the sense of why does Jeremiah Smith, who acted this way in Telithicumi, act very differently in Herrenvalk? And I'm just kind of like, well, I think what we're meant to intuit is that, you know, the one who escapes from the jail is not the same one who comes to visit Scully. They are of the same mind, but the one who comes to visit Scully is kind of putting on courage a little more than the one who's in the jail, who really has a courageous sense, and who is the one, I think, as I interpret it, who then shows up in This Is Not Happening in season 8.
Yes, yeah.
When Jeremy Smith comes back. You know, it's my interpretation that the one who escapes from jail basically just vanishes. Mm-hmm. And then one of his brothers, so to speak, which is why, otherwise, like, why would we be told that there are five Jeremiah Smiths? It's kind of like, and so that's why I think that little clue is basically then there for us to perhaps make the leap in interpretation that the one who comes to visit Scully and then ultimately takes Mulder through the hive in Canada and everything like that is a different Jeremiah Smith who also has a moral sense but is a bit more cowardly.
I never thought about that as a theory. I think it's really interesting. I was having enough trouble just figuring out which one was Jeremiah Smith and which one was the bounty hunter pretending to be Jeremiah Smith. So it took me a while just to sort that out. So I was very pleased with myself that I'm like, oh, okay, so the one who comes to visit Scully, that's real Jeremiah Smith again. And I was like, I've got it all figured out. But now you've kind of blown my mind, Keith, to think that that's the real Jeremiah Smith, but maybe a different real Jeremiah Smith. I'm going to rewatch the episode with that in mind because that's really interesting to
because
me.
Because you're right, there really is no other reason to give us that information, that there are multiple Jeremiah Smiths.
I always thought that the reason for that information was so that we'd be confused about who was the imposter Jeremiah in Telithicumi, the one who was pretending to be him, who turned out to be the ABH, but was, but we were to think that that was just another Jeremiah Smith. So that's
right.
That's why I thought that that seed was planted, was that we wouldn't suspect that that was the alien bounty hunter. And we'd be really surprised when it turned out to be that we would just think, oh, that's okay. It's just another Jeremiah Smith.
Yeah. I mean, the thing of it is, of course, is that all these aliens, including the bounty hunters, have shape-shifting abilities, it seems. So, yeah. I mean, are some of those Jeremiah Smiths, shall we say, bounty hunters? I mean, maybe one of them, but there are five. There are five specifically. And it's kind of my supposition that probably we definitely see two. We might even actually see three of those five in this particular two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on where you interpret with the bounty hunter. Like, is the bounty hunter, this particular bounty hunter himself, working in, you know, a Social Security Administration? Because actually now I'm thinking the last time you see the bounty hunter in the series is at the end of Without in season 8, with the whole rotation around Mulder on the alien table. And it's like they've killed the bounty hunter on Earth, but then there are all these five other bounty hunters who are surrounding Mulder on the table.
Right.
So they're the same kind of thing. Like, you know, there are many aliens who effectively have the same face or the same human face that recurs. And some of them have a moral sense and such. And so in my interpretation, there are two Jeremiah Smiths who have a moral sense. And it's just, we get the really courageous one and the one who's kind of wants to be courageous, but is a little more like,
I like that theory. It's really interesting.
I do. Yeah. I like it too. So let's, I mean, we already talked a bit about this jail cell scene, but just if there's any information that you want to discuss that came up in this, the most interesting thing that I take away from this scene is the fact that they say here the date is set. This is something that is planted in season 3 that seemingly comes out of nowhere in the truth in the series finale. And I remember when I first watched the series finale thinking it came out of nowhere. And then realizing, well, no, they talk about it here. They talk about it, I think, in Patient X also. Like, specifically the colonization and the fact that the date has been set for the colonization. Like, these are things that are just throwaway lines, but they're here. They're planted. And I just find that incredible.
Yeah, no, it's... there's so much in the jail conversation.
Yeah.
We could probably talk about just that conversation for like an hour, I think, picking apart the interesting bits in it. I'm going to just quickly throw out what I took from it, because I just have little bits that I took from it. And for me, it was more about the themes that it sort of touches on rather than, I mean, the information's really interesting too, but there's lots of mention of hope and the providing of hope and the danger of hope.
Yeah.
And the degree to which that is a danger to the plans of the syndicate versus this idea of, you know, just having to just sad resignation. The date is set. So it's that hope versus resignation. And also there's a lot of religious imagery thrown in there about God and miracles, which I find kind of interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe in God, but they do believe in like superstition or something,
and there's this idea that like they don't believe in God, that science has become their god in a sense, and that science and that belief is really important to whatever the syndicate is up to, which I found interesting. I mean, there's an interesting sort of parallel in terms of what is science here. It's sort of a dangerous thing. It's presented as belief in science being dangerous, but then of course we'll talk about in Heron Folk that Scully's belief in science is presented as hopeful. So I think this brings up some of those sort of interesting themes for me.
Yeah. I mean, as far as the fact, because I've talked about some of the themes already in the scene. So in terms of the facts, the narrative, I'm trying to remember if there was an earlier episode where there's some mention of a date, and I'm blanking on if there is necessarily, but I do believe this is the real point where it's kind of really hammered home. The date is set.
Yeah.
And ultimately where the series goes through the original series, you know, that date is ultimately the end of the Mayan calendar, you know, December 22nd, 2012.
Right.
And then of course, taking then with the revival series and everything, you then realize that when I think the alien colonization plan falls apart, Smoking Man just uses the fact of that date having been set as a manipulative tactic to instill fear, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, another main theme of this particular conversation, I think it's Jeremiah Smith. I don't remember if he's in the form of either Bill Mulder or Deep Throat when he's saying it, but that he says to Smoking Man, you know, you look at you live in fear,
yeah,
or something. You are, which is like such a perfect epitome of I think
Smoking Man. Yeah,
you know, he is the devil, you know, but he's also human, and because mm-hmm. he's human, he's subject to all human feelings and frailties, and his main thing is fear. He wants to survive.
Yeah, you know? Well, like he kind of represents fear, and Mulder and Scully represent the hope, and I like that.
Yeah,
that sort of.
But the thing is, he then puts that fear on them, and sometimes really gets to them.
Yeah,
and it manipulates them. Though the hope thing, interesting, if you remember the last line of the original series, Mulder says maybe there's hope.
Yeah,
you know, Scully and he, you know, Scully helps talk him around back into. And so a lot of what the series is and will become is encapsulated in this two scene conversation, which is another reason I love it so much. I really feel like it's a crux on which a lot of the narrative and especially the thematic side of it.
Yeah, the thematic for sure.
When we talked last time on my last conversation here, you know, I talked about how on the level of theme, I think the show is pretty well nigh unimpeachable. You know, I think it's pretty perfect on the level of theme, and that it's where we have the issue a lot of the time is in, you know, the narrative construction and how it's enacted and such. It's mm-hmm. sloppy that way.
Yeah.
But you know, then my shoot back to that as well. You know, the Bible's, you know, a sloppy story, but so many people, you know, love it, and yeah, I mean, and call it and several things in it the greatest story ever told. So you know, it's like, but
yeah to each their own.
But it's not necessarily because it's the best told story in the world. It's just there's something about it that just captures it
exactly.
And that's what you know, I think the X-Files is, you know, is if it's riffing on Dostoevsky here in these scenes in Toto, I think it's riffing on the religious texts,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the world, you know, throughout its entire run. And that's, and kind of playing on that and exploring like how, you know, why do we fall under the spell of this? You know,
yeah.
What do we, you know, and what good things do we find? What destructive things do we find? So, yeah.
Well, and I love the idea too that they bring up, like Jen, you were talking about how they do bring up a lot of that religious stuff here and like about God. And I feel like at that point in this conversation is when I swear to God, I start to tune out because I'm like, okay, you've touched on like five themes in this one scene and I don't know what I'm supposed to focus on. But bringing up the God stuff, I think is important because that's sort of what, like you, like Keith, you always said that Chris Carter, what he thinks is what this is probably about is that it's this show is about the search for God. And yes. I like to say the search for truth because I feel like that's a slightly less religiously connotated way to say it. But it's all wrapped up in the human experience. And I like the idea that they take aliens and God and they mix those together so often. And I mean, later when we get like to like the biogenesis arc and all of that stuff, they really, you know, literally hit on that as like, maybe aliens are God. And I mean, I like that it gets so murky that you start to go, what is anything anymore? And I think that's the point. Like they really want you to think about this stuff.
Well, and I would say, I think Carter is actually quoted, as I recall, several times saying, you know, the show is about the search for God. I think that interestingly, probably would be Frank Spotnitz who would say it's about the search for truth. Because
mm-hmm.
as I recall, Spotnitz kind of talked about his relationship, you know, writing relationship with Carter, and that Chris is the believer, Frank was not.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and that dynamic actually lent itself to a lot of the mythology, especially when Spotnitz became, he was like the main runner with Carter of the mythology.
Yeah.
And I think that was really starting at this point, or it had really like solidified at this point, because, I think Spotnitz wrote, Endgame was the first one, right? But this is the season when he was really starting to become more involved. And then you start to see a lot of the mythology or either story by Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz or mm-hmm. written by Chris mm-hmm. Carter and Frank Spotnitz, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So,
I was just going to say, you mentioned Frank Spotnitz, and it reminds me of what Frank said in our last interview with him about the importance of love and that being like a certain sort of faith in itself.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that that comes up in this sort of jailhouse conversation as well, that where Jeremiah says, you can't kill their love, which is what makes them who they are, makes them better than us. And yeah. So I love the idea that love, even at that point, is kind of being elevated as this sort of great thing. It's one of my favorite themes in The X-Files.
Yeah.
Which plays into the Mulder-Scully relationship and their slow
discovery
of
that.
Yeah. But we see their love throughout this two-parter as well. Yeah, no, so there's a lot of love to be seen here.
Yeah.
Right.
It doesn't need to be just sexual, although, dear God.
Yeah. It does eventually, but the love is always present, so that's nice.
I was always happy with any hug I could get.
Mm-hmm.
Me too, baby, but I mean, Jesus. Butcher, let me tell you.
Yeah, oh, geez.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you wanted to say on this jailhouse scene before we sort of wrap up the end of this episode?
I mean, I think we touched it, yeah. It was like, yeah.
Like I said, we could analyze it all day, but I think I've highlighted the most important bits for me.
Yeah,
and I've highlighted the visual aspects of it. I mean, that was like the thing too and everything. But yeah, go on.
I have a question. How does he get away? How does he get out of the jail cell?
I have an answer.
Okay, please.
We both do. I'll hear yours first, Keith. It'll probably be the same as mine, I suspect.
Well, we'll see. I mean, Smith says you are dying of lung cancer, and Smoking Man, being the self-preservationist that he is, you know, basically, I think, you know, gets healed. Mm-hmm. And the trade-off for that is that he lets him go and gets him out.
Okay.
It took me a few views to get that, but I've come away with that same belief, because he specifically brings up the lung cancer and CSM says, you're only saying that to save your life. And Jeremiah's like, well, what about you? Like, don't you want to save your life? And then we never hear about the lung cancer again. So I presume that's Jeremiah healed him and let him out, thus showing that CSM is actually quite sort of selfish and will do anything to kind of help himself. That's the fear again.
I think you're right. I like that theory, but the lung cancer does come back.
It comes back, as cancer does.
Yes, Requiem.
But at that point, he was literally dying, according to Jeremiah.
But I thought that was the brain thing, because Smoking Man's body was rejecting the material that, like, you know, was transferred from Mulder's brain in 66.
Yeah. Oh, he is. He does say he's dying from the effects of the brain surgery again, which is why Mulder is dying too, Jen.
Right.
But I have to say that they do. I swear to God, Marita says something to Krycek about him dying of lung cancer. Am I making that up?
I think she just says he's dying.
Okay. Although, then I take it all back. It isn't the lung cancer.
Although, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's another situation where you're given two conflicting sets of information within the narrative.
Right.
And it's really just like I could see, like, Marita saying that, you know, in order to just provide a cover or something.
Yeah. But like, maybe Smoky Man doesn't want them to know the real reason.
Following that whole arc, it's basically like Mulder, you know, whatever the alien stuff in Mulder's head that Smoking Man took, Smoking Man's body was rejecting. So,
right.
But I think that there's definitely reason to believe he did have lung cancer at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And that Jeremiah healed it, and that's why he got let go.
I believe
that later in the episode, when Mulder sees him in the Rhode Island hospital, when Smoking Man is, like, smoking in the hallway of the hospital,
and he goes there.
I believe one of the signs that he's near is oncology ward. So I believe what we're meant to intuit is that Smoking Man is there not only to look over Tina Mulder, but also he was getting tested to see if indeed the cancer was healed.
Yeah.
Which I think it actually proved to be. If we want to lay out all these facts, you know, I mean, he probably has other ways of figuring that out too. But and really, it could just be a really funny visual composition of it's like, oh, you know, maybe he's checking in on whether this actual miracle, you know, worked.
But I think you're right. And I really like that. And I don't think I never really made that connection. I was always just like, I guess he just got away. I never really added that up before, but that makes sense. I mean, because that's what Smoking Man would do. Like you said, he's self-preservationalist. So,
yeah. I mean, I remember that this was a real sticking point for a lot of people at the time. They were like, why was the lung cancer never brought up again? And blah, 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 blah. And I think it's more that just like in the toto of the series, it's like, well, you know, the revelations that we get, we often have to intuit because they tend to happen off screen.
Yeah.
You know?
And like CSM's healing was happened off screen.
Yeah.
Right. So and some of it I think does come off narratively very sloppy, and other of it though kind of stokes my imagination and kind of like, oh, I have to intuit this and what this means, and I kind of like that it's murky. And this, that all varies from plot twist to plot twist, frankly. But
Jen always loves when I bring up Diana Fowley, but that's my headcanon too, that's how she was healed, that she's, you know, she's working for the syndicate and you think she's dead, you think she's gone, and then suddenly she's back and she's fine. And I'm like, oh, well, she must have been healed by the alien bounty hunter. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So,
and ultimately she dies off screen, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but don't even get me started about that.
And I didn't mean to. I'm just talking about the healing properties and intuiting what has occurred. That's another instance that's like off screen.
I like the David team with his Rapture co-star Mimi Rogers again. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen the Rapture where she's like a crazy religious freak and David and she have like amazing softcore sex and
Jen, you should watch that. I think you would enjoy
that
it.
Yeah, it's not going to happen ever in my whole life.
And then they become religious freaks, but yeah.
I saw that movie. I thought it was pretty good what I recall.
I'm not even listening to this.
She's like, why are we talking about Diana Fowley every
la,
time?
La, 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 la.
I just do it to irritate her because it's fun.
Yeah, you do.
But anyway.
I should be here for all the Diana Fowley episodes.
Oh, definitely. Yes, you're going to have to come back.
I'll let you two just talk about her and I'll just pretend I'm not even here.
Keith, we're going to have you back for more for sure. But let's definitely do some Diana Fowley because that would be fun. I would just love to gang up on Jen. That would be just so much fun. Oh, man.
Bring it on. I'm ready.
She is ready. Let me tell you. Oh, man. Okay. Well, so we're cruising in on the end of Talitha Kumai here. This is where I'm trying to like make sense of my notes here. After CSM and Mulder have their fight, which I think is a great scene. I love that scene.
Yeah, can I just quickly say I love it when Mulder says, "You want to smoke on that?" his cigarette, or "Do you want to smoke on this?" My God. And CSM says, "Are you giving me a choice?" And I love that line.
Yeah.
I just love how chill he is all the time. It's like
so chill. With a gun in his face.
Yeah. It's like he knows, though, that Mulder's not going to do it.
Yeah.
Say that again, Keith.
He's watched presidents die.
Yes. That's right.
Don't threaten me, Mulder. I've watched presidents die.
I love that line.
He has no shits to give.
Yeah.
So we have a scene, though, with Mulder and X. I'm trying to remember here. I have this on.
Yeah. There's like
X is looking for the weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's the fight scene, which actually was because I'll show you. I have my handy guide from season three, as well as from season four for her.
Love it.
Handy.
But yeah, in this it said that the fight scene was actually cut down because of standards and practices.
It's so pretty long already.
Yeah,
it was apparently even more violent and stuff. And I think this is one case where you can see a little bit more of the stunt double work than I might particularly like, frankly. Yeah. But that's all right. I mean, because really, I mean, I don't know that anything's ever going to beat the X Skinner thing in the elevator in it's Endgame or is it Colony?
I think Endgame.
I think it's Endgame. Yeah, where it's just the headbutting. Yeah. Right. I remember Frank Spotnitz specifically talked about like that was his initial script and like he wrote that scene and like that was one of the first scenes he wrote, I think, was like
X and Skinner in the elevator.
The headbutt competition.
Yeah.
Which is just one of the greatest things ever.
It's just brutal, but I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one kinda pales a little bit for me in that way. I would say that was a point of criticism for me this is a point where I feel like the fight seems a little wheel spinny to me.
Yeah. It goes on longer than it has to for me as well. Like, let's just move on here. This isn't doing anything for me. But Mulder does say that those keywords again in his conversation with X, we're talking about colonization. Yeah, the date is set. So Mulder uses the same phrase, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
No, indeed.
So he ends up at this. And I was going to ask because I just forgot. I'm sure they said it. How does he end up at this mill? Who tells him to go there?
That's what I was going to ask that because I have no understanding how he winds up at that mill because he's talking to X, he's fighting with X, and then suddenly he's telling Scully, "You have to meet me at this mill," but I have no idea why.
Yeah.
I think it's just he knows it as a place where they can go to be alone.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, it's just kind of
just place.
Then later becomes their makeout place, right?
Kind of okay. Like,
nice. Maybe it already was.
It kind of looked like it was in the same area as where the sugar factory is at the end of the series now.
Yeah.
Before. Yeah. I was kind of looking at, like, it's like, oh, that seems like it's probably in the area of where they shot the real end of the series now.
It's got a similar
yeah,
vibe.
Sort of been, yeah, mm-hmm. That kind of old industrial look.
No, I was to say, I do think it's funny how when he's on the phone with Scully and he says it's off the I-95, which I think that's a little bit of West Coast David coming out. Because as I understand, if you're on the East Coast, you do not say the. You would say I-95, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and you do. Yeah.
Because here, out here, you say the. I got to hop on the 405. I got to hop on the 5. Like, you would say the. But
yeah. I mean, honestly, it's so easy to be nitpicky about directional sense in fiction and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a colleague of mine is like a stickler for anything that's shot in New York. If the characters do not get uptown or downtown in exactly the way you would get uptown or downtown in life, he's like, you could never get to that location for this in the way that they did it, you know. And it's just like, okay, you know, I mean,
this isn't a nitpick, this is just me pointing out LA David, even though he's not in LA yet. It's just he's not necessarily an East Coaster, I suppose. For that to come out,
Chris Carter wrote the scene, so, you know, I mean, like,
yeah. Well, I don't know possible. If it says that in the script, because I don't have the script for this, but I should check
that.
I should
it could just all he was tired and was just like the I-95,
right. Oh, I just thought it was worth pointing out. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I mean, I would Thank say you. Here, interestingly enough, it is interesting that they feel okay giving that location, you know, so specifically over the phone, considering by this point they know they've been tapped multiple times.
Right.
Yeah, really.
I mean, this is where I get a little nitpicky about things. I almost wanted it to be like, I wish he had said something like, Scully, meet me at that place near that thing where we went that or something
yeah.
like
that. Yeah, like something that would jar a memory that wouldn't necessarily be specific, but you know.
But I don't necessarily know how you do that. And
communicate
so, I mean,
to the viewer.
They need to figure out a way to do that.
They need a little system. Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
Guys, this is why writing is hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You figure out little details.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, it's very difficult to do that when you're making 24 episodes of hour-long television a year. So
you're right. Like, absolutely.
So I mean, ultimately, I forgive it. It's just like they need to get there to move the ball.
And it is an interesting location.
And there may have been something that was edited out that explained more about how Mulder got from A to B there. So,
right.
But, you know, it's fine.
It works.
I didn't even notice it, honestly, until I rewatched it this week. And then I was like, hang on a second.
Yeah, I didn't either. Yeah. But I was just kind of like, we're at this really interesting location. Why?
It was a great location.
Yeah, it was just, I know. And it is cool. And I mean, this is the cliffhanger we were referring to, quote unquote cliffhanger, where, you know, ABH shows up. Sorry, Alien Bounty Hunter. And he's walking towards them. And then we're done. To be continued.
The very conspicuously ADR'd, meaning dialogue replacement after the fact, he's here to kill me.
Yeah. You know, just to be clear, I mean, and why would they say, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there would be higher stakes if we weren't sure what he was there to do, because maybe we would think Mulder and Scully were in danger and we would be slightly more panicky for them. But saying specifically he's here to kill me this moment was an interesting choice, especially if you say this was a choice made in ADR, which I didn't notice, but
I mean, it sounded like ADR.
Yeah, it could have been ADR, but also scripted.
I think that you're right, Annie, that it tends to sort of take a little bit of suspense out of the scene, because otherwise just having him advance on the three of them would be, to me, a little scarier without knowing his exact intention.
And if they wanted to make that clear, they could have very easily done that in the opening scene of Herrenvolk, so...
And what's interesting is that in Herrenvolk, that line is not there.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, we've already gotten that information maybe in the previously on the X-Files.
Yeah, no.
So.
I found it's not helpful because we know that ABH is not there to hug them. We know he's there to cause trouble. So
really?
Let's just
I think
leave
he would
that.
Give. I think that ABH would give really good bear hugs. I think.
Would.
He's a big guy. Yeah.
He could.
What a lovely way to end this episode, you guys. Keith, you are going to join us for part two of this two-parter. But let's wrap up this episode, and we will see you guys back here in a couple weeks with more mythology and Keith talking about Herrenvolk. In the meantime, please tweet at us at XFD Podcast if you have anything to say about any of these plot issues that we are talking about. And in the meantime, we will see you guys back here in 2 weeks on another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.